Well, our nation turns 239 years old this holiday weekend, and I know that quick math because I was born in the bicentennial, so I am going to be officially pushing 40 in the next couple of months. At the same time, our little show here is turning 6 months old this week, if I'm not mistaken.
You are not.
Yeah, and that's senior producer Arwin Nix.
Hello.
You just heard there, and I'm also joined by producer Kevin Kniestad.
Morning.
I am Gabriel Spitzer. We're thinking about growing up today and growing older, and some of the things we leave behind as we grow older. And I wonder if you guys feel like you've given up on certain things now that we are grown people.
Well, I can tell you this. I thought I would never grow out of any sort of social media at all. I was the first kid I knew that could log into the King County Library System chat room and talk to other people on that. And then, of course, I was the first to have Prodigy. I was the first to have CompuServe. I was the first to have AOL with a 1,000 free hour disk that came in the mail. And then, like, I was all about MySpace. And MySpace was never going to go away. And when people started transitioning to Facebook, it was like, what are you guys doing? What are you giving up on here? And so, like, then there became...
Why would you possibly need something that MySpace doesn't offer?
Right, that's what I thought. And then I kind of felt very forced into Twitter, and Instagram wasn't even a consideration for me, and I never thought I was going to grow out of social media.
All right, so Kevin has grown out of, or is growing out of social media. What about you, Arwin?
I feel a little hesitant to say this, but I think people, basically. And I mean this in the way that I used to be an incredibly social person. I used to go out all the time. I was excited every time, like, I switched high schools because I got to meet new people. Like, it wasn't a scary thing to me. And now thinking about going to a show exhausts me. Getting, like, friend requests or event invitations on Facebook, I find insulting. Like, I don't, I want...
insulting. How dare you like me? Who do you think you are?
My girlfriend and I have plans to each stay at our respective homes this evening and watch Grey's Anatomy and text each other about it.
So Arwin has given up on being an extrovert. It would be a nicer way to say it. And I can relate to that. I mean, I feel like the thing that I've given up on is music, or like having taste in general. And when I was younger, I was pretty into music. I mean, I was into punk rock and indie music and that kind of stuff. And I felt like that was really important to defining who I was. Having a sophisticated taste around music and around that kind of culture was about rejecting normalcy or rejecting the, I don't really know what I was rejecting exactly. There was a good 3-4 years recently where I listened to nothing except children's music.
Oh.
And I just don't have the time or the energy to like keep up with music anymore. I just can't get myself to do it. But it also makes me feel a little comforted because it reminds me of how superficial that always was and how it's such a function of like who your friends happen to be and what your older brother happened to bring home from the record shop. So in that way, it's sort of bitter and sweet. And I guess that's a lot of growing up is bittersweet. It's these growing pains that come along with shedding our younger selves. And that's actually what we're going to be talking about today on the show. Growing pains here on Sound Effect. And we are going to be trying something a little bit different today. Normally, we would hop right over to our panel of news watchers right about here to talk over the week's top stories. But today, we are going to be hearing from our news folks at the end of the show. And we're going to be really drilling down on our underreported stories of the week. So stay tuned for that. And right now, we're going to get right into our discussion of growing pains here on Sound Effect from KPLU. First off, we are going to take a look at a growing business. Dr. Jen, also known as Jennifer Dietrich, found her way to cosmetics by accident. She was a research chemist, and one day she was running an experiment and waiting around for some data. That's something that scientists do a lot, wait for data. So she was surfing around, and she came across a website that scores skincare and beauty products on a scale of 1 to 10 for how many harmful chemicals they contain, 1 being pretty good and 10 being chock full of toxins. So Jen decided to look up all the stuff that she used, and she was completely mortified at what she found.
So I had a mild nervous breakdown and threw everything in my bathroom away. And then when I came to, I was like, oh, what do? I don't have anything. And then I was like, well, come on, emulsion chemistry. Let's go do some stuff. And so I just started making products for me.
Soon she started making products for friends, too. And then more people started asking for them, and she opened up a space. And the business grew, and she had to move to a bigger space in Seattle's Capitol Hill neighborhood. And that's how Dr. Jen's House of Beauty was born. So I met up with her this week at her store, which is also where she makes her products.
You can't see this, people in Radioland, but if you were to turn your head to the left, you would see a fully functioning lab where we make everything that we sell.
It looks like a mad scientist and a chef moved in together, and the rest of the shop is really, it's really sparkly.
Every color of glitter known to man, and we've arranged it loosely in Roy G. Biv, because science.
You can tell she loves this place, and I asked her why she decided to open this store on Capitol Hill.
Oh, Capitol Hill, because I love Capitol Hill. It's the weird kid neighborhood, you know, where like everybody that's the weird kid can go and be themselves and nobody cares, right? Like you can be a bearded lady, you can be a drag queen, you can be a flaming homosexual, you can be a straight person, you can be the dude that wears like one color all the time and dyes his beard and his hair and all this, like, you know, it's awesome. It's that funky, like, artist community that's just, like, got that sort of independent, slightly punk rock spirit. Like, I just loved it. We fit. It's a wonderful, it was a wonderful place.
Well, that kind of brings us to the elephant in the room, right? The elephant in the room is that there's actually nobody in the room. There's no customers in here. You've got white paper on the windows. What's going on?
Well, we have actually closed our location here at East Pike and Boylston. Saturday was our last day. We've decided to move to a more distributed business model. We're going to move to online sales and pop-up shops, and you know, we'll be vending at larger events and things of that nature, which wasn't really what we had envisioned for the immediate short term. But given what's happening in Capitol Hill, it was a decision that was kind of, I won't say forced on us, but it was one that was, you know, really put right in our faces.
What's happening on Capitol Hill?
Anybody who's been down on Capitol Hill recently has seen the massive amount of construction. You know, if you haven't seen it, you might be blind. Get your eyes checked. but no, I mean, it's disrupting everything. I mean, there's this massive, everybody's been hearing it. We have this huge tech influx. You know, we've got Amazon coming in, Expedia's moving all their employees up here, and Google's up here. I mean, we're like the new Silicon Valley, right? And they all need a place to live. And I guess that the city council has decided that the First Hills, Capitol Hill corridor is where most of that growth is going to happen.
And so growth sounds like a good thing. What's the harm?
It is a good thing. I mean, everybody wants the city to grow, right? But rampant, uncontrolled growth with no regard whatsoever for the existing communities in which you're growing is not a good thing.
Well, let's go out in front of your store here on the sidewalk and see if we can kind of get a visual on that. So we're here at Pike and Boylston, and can you describe kind of what it looks like and how, if at all, that differs from what it looked like when you moved in?
Well, yes. Actually, when I moved into this space, directly across the street was the old Mercedes dealership, which now is under construction. It's being turned into retail on the bottom and condos on top. Diagonally from the store was, like, you know, just your basic, what was there? It was like an apartment building, and then the old that old soccer field was right there. And that is now a giant construction site as well. There is, if you walk to the end of our block, there is an empty garage, which is about to begin they're going to start working on that soon. And then directly up Boylston, in the middle of the block, one of those houses is coming down to make another condo unit.
So you went from a period where this was kind of scruffy, right? A little, you know, mixed use, different kinds of stuff here. And now what's it going to look like, you think, in 6 months or a year?
Bellevue. It's going to look like Bellevue. Welcome to Little Bellevue. It's going to be South Lake Union. And I guess if you like South Lake Union, then you'll love it here.
But couldn't you still make a business? I mean, there's still going to be people here. There's still going to be pedestrians. You're going to have a lot more people. So couldn't you stay in business if you wanted to?
I could. I could alter my business model to work for these people. But I have not, what I have seen of them is not a good thing. I recognize that what I've seen is a small subset of all of the people coming in. But the one really big problem that I have down here is the clash of cultures that's going on. You know, through the issuing of too many liquor licenses, we've become somewhat like Pioneer Square in the evening. So you have, the Bridge and Tunnel crowd coming in on the weekend, well, every night to get drunk. And then you have the changing demographic as well. You know, the artists are being driven out, and it's, primarily more affluent, I'm going to say tech employees, but I don't know that for sure. Nobody like start yelling. and the problem that's coming from that is all of these people coming in are not really necessarily very educated or tolerant of the gayborhood that they're moving into. And the queers aren't happy because they feel that they're just being, you know, shoved out. And then the new people coming in aren't happy because they're meeting all this resistance from, you know, the people that were here. And it's just like everybody's at loggerheads. And if you go out here at night, it's awful. And so part of the reason that I am not interested in adapting my business model is that, you know, I don't want to be Bath and Body Works. I don't want to work for assholes. Like, if I wanted to do that, I would have become a lawyer. Like, you know, it would have been easier. The Hill is pretty much dead. I guess that's probably a really unpopular opinion. But, you know, when Edge of the Circle lost its lease, you know,
what's that?
Edge of the Circle, the little witchy bookstore right here.
It's across the street. Can we just walk over there?
They got a month's notice to get out of the building they've been in for 20 years.
So this is a cult themed
bookstore.
Mm-hmm. And it's got a pentagram in its logo and stuff like that. What does this symbolize to you, the fact that these guys are losing their lease?
When I found that they lost their lease, I was like, that's it. That's it. The seals are broken. The horsemen are on the loose. This is end of days.
Do you ever wonder, though, if you're like being a little unduly harsh on the your new neighbors?
It is possible.
Do you think what's happening on Capitol Hill is something that people who don't live here ought to care about? People in other parts of the city, or people in the suburbs, or people, you know, elsewhere in the Puget Sound region? Should it matter to them what's going on in this neighborhood?
It should. It, for a lot of reasons. I mean, A, because it could very easily happen in their neighborhood. You know, all it would take would be, you know, some big company deciding they want to move themselves in there, and then all of a sudden, you know, whatever neighborhood, Ballard or, you know, West Seattle or Hell Burien, you know, suddenly starts getting built up. You know, so they should care. Another reason to care is that it's destroying a community. It's destroying an artist community, not just a community. You know, without the arts, life is a very drab, monochromatic place, right? And it's sort of intangible what arts brings to us, but it's so important to everybody's daily lives, especially now when things are so, so crappy. And then, you know, the idea of a community being destroyed, part of what I've tried to do while I've been here, my philosophy is you can no longer trust that help is going to come from above, right? So you help the people around you. And you know, like, I've donated a whole day's sales to somebody, one of the members of the burlesque community, who lost a baby in a house in 24 hours because she needed help. I'm part of her community, and she's helped me before, and we all help each other, right? And when you destroy communities, you take away those safety nets that people have that can jump in and help them in times of extremes when the government is not available to do it. And so, yeah, everybody should care about what's going on. I mean, it's important.
Well, Dr. Jen, I want to thank you so much for being on our show, Sound Effect.
Oh, well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Jennifer Dietrich owns Dr. Jen's House of Beauty. She just closed down her retail shop on Capitol Hill. You're listening to Sound Effect from KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Today, we are talking about growing pains. And I think one of the most painful parts about growing up is listening to adults try and teach you about sex. You know, once you hit puberty, it's almost impossible to get really useful stuff from your parents. And while I'm sure there are some really great sex ed classes out there, you probably didn't get most of your real deal information from teachers. And of course, there's always the internet. But before you cringe, you should know about this website called scarletteen.com. Lots of teens, millions actually, go there for real-world info and advice. Sound Effect producer Kevin Kniestad went to Vashon Island to meet with Heather Carina. She created Scarlet Teen. And we should note that some of this conversation might not be appropriate for some listeners. They talked about what kinds of questions she answers and how she got into the sex advice business in the first place.
I was teaching full-time, actually, in early childhood ed, and then kind of writing adult sexuality work in my off time, and there was this newfangled internet thing. And so I first started doing kind of adult sexuality, kind of sexuality arts, and then also merged with kind of health advice work. And within about 6 months of doing that, that was 97, the end of 97, started getting advice, letters, and questions from teenagers. Figured I should refer them to something for them. There wasn't a something for them. So we made a small site, 5 pages. I thought that that would do it, which is really hilarious. I mean, Scarlatina at this point is, when you include the message boards and all of the advice columns, it's millions of pages. At this point, we serve about 5 million young people internationally a year, which is kind of crazy. And we try not to think about it when we're making content so we don't get performance anxiety.
So I want to get some, maybe a few reoccurring questions that you get, and then, you know, maybe a few examples of some surprises.
Things like, how do you know something's feeling good? Which maybe seems like a silly question, except that when people say you're supposed to feel a certain way and it doesn't, it's not silly. It makes quite a lot of sense, you know? And how do you tell somebody that you're interested in them? How do you tell someone you want to have sex with them without coming off like a creeper? Am I ready? Right, is a big one. And sometimes paired with that, or really the opposite of that, which is the did I have sex question. So that's a big one. I mean, when I first came into that, that blew my mind, right? Like, I was just like, what? I don't even know that I knew how to answer that one. Probably a lot of my initial answers were, I don't think I know how to answer this question. I mean, I think one of the more surprising things to me over the last few years are a lot of young people feeling like they have to somehow, I don't know how, because I'm 45 and I still don't, like magically know every single aspect of who they are as a sexual person and with their sexual identity, right? So if they're questioning their orientation in some way, they're often really, really bothered and upset by the fact that they don't have an answer, right? And, you know, our comeback will usually be, well, often you don't. And again, really probably your whole life, you won't 100% know who you are. But for a lot of them, it produces a lot of anxiety.
I imagine that you probably get a lot of questions about virginity.
Did I lose my virginity? What is it, right? What does it mean? And most of these questions, for all of the, I mean, I don't even know, thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of people who have asked, like, did I lose my virginity? They have always been people who identified as women. I have yet to have a guy say, did I, which is kind of fascinating.
What are some of the big concerns that you get? If, I mean, following the question, did I, why are they worried? What's the concern?
Well, you know, one of the big ones is that it still looms large that you're supposed to be married, right? So if you had some kind of sex that involved losing, again, bunny ears around this lose, give, take stuff, your virginity, it's supposed to be with somebody that you're married. So, I mean, there's that larger piece of that. But then for people who have gone ahead and decided to do that, there's also the piece of, yes, I decided, right, to have this kind of sex before I got married. And probably they're relatively cool with that, so long as it's worth what, how you've, again, big bunny ears, spoiled yourself, right, in that way. Because if you did before you got married, and then when you get married, it's like this terrible story and it's not good, it wasn't worth it, right? So that's a big deal. And I think equally too, there's kind of a double pressure where there's this idea, this cultural idea that your first sexual experiences are like your most important and your best ones, which is crazy, right? I mean, we don't, like when we see a baby take first steps and they're stumbling and they're falling, we're not being like, oh my God, you're right, they're totally messing this up. Why can't they just get it together, right? We expect them to stumble and fall, usually for quite a long time. So there's this thing where it's, you know, if you do it, it's supposed to be the best, again, to make it worth it, that you've sullied yourself, that you've spoiled yourself, that you've broken the rules, that you've done this thing in this way that you're not supposed to, that if it was, you know, anywhere from utter crap to just like, okay, then that's not so good either. And one of the things that we have to remind our users about a lot, which is really quite upsetting, is that there definitely is this notion that once you say yes to a certain kind of sex, certainly with the person you said yes to, there's this implied yes ever after. But then also in a bigger way, there's an implied yes ever after to anybody and everybody, right? And we have to remind them a lot that, you know, saying yes to one thing at a time is saying yes to one thing at a time. It means absolutely nothing, right? And if someone assumes that it does, they're assuming incorrectly. You know, we certainly have people come in who... they engage in a kind of sex they thought that they were ready, and then they realize they weren't, right? Stuff is freaking them out. It's not making them comfortable. They feel panicked about it, but they don't feel like they have permission to dial it back. And our answer, of course, is, you know, you can do this the one time and not do this again for like 10 years or ever if you want. And that's again, just like anything else, right? I saw this movie. This movie sucked. You don't have to see the movie again, right? You don't have to. You can never see that movie again.
Are there questions that you either are surprised you don't get a whole lot of on your website, or you wish you got asked more?
I wish that we had more conversations where, rather than people focusing on what they're doing, right, and what other people thought about it, we're more focused on what they're feeling and what they're thinking and what they feel about it. The tricky thing is that, of course, if you're focused on all of those other things, figuring out what you want, making sexual choices that are the ones that you really feel good about, right? They're not right for somebody else. They're not what somebody else told you is that you should feel good about, but you really do. It's much, much harder, if not impossible, really, to get there if you don't focus on the other things.
So you've been doing this a while. Seems like it's a lot of hard work. What's your motivation for doing it still?
I love it. You know, I'm one of these people, and a lot of kind of activists are like this, and certainly a lot of teachers, where it's not necessarily what I would have picked. And with Scarlet Teen, it's really not what I picked, right? It's a bunch of young people kept picking me, and more kept picking me. why they kept picking me, I can't tell you, but it's awesome. I feel of use, which is great. It's something that, you know, if this is ever not needed, I'll do something else. But I've been at this almost 2 decades, and there's no signs of it not being needed. On a good day, you can have somebody come in so distraught and overwrought about this, and they're leaving, right? They're leaving with you guys making jokes and laughing, and they feel comfortable. And that's happened, you know, maybe over a couple of days. Sometimes that's happened in an hour. And you're lifting a burden off of something that's not supposed to be a burden, right? Sex is supposed to be about pleasure. It's supposed to be something that brings us joy in our lives and makes us happy and takes away stress. And the minute that they realize that they've found some place where not only is it safe to ask their questions, but that they've also found people who are qualified to answer their questions and educated. And so the answers are not only going to be sensitive and kind and supportive, they're also going to be accurate. If we can do one more step and give them all of that and then direct them to in-person services, I mean, it's a really good day.
Sound effect producer Kevin Kniestad talking to Heather Carina, the creator of the website scarletteen.com. It's Sound Effect, and next on our exploration of growing pains, Kevin peeks into another unique online community. So we all know that adolescence is torture. Okay, maybe I'm projecting a little bit here, but really, you know, there's grades and there's hormones and parents and figuring out who the hell you are. And if that's not bad enough, everything has an even sharper edge when you also have to deal with being obese. Dr. Robert Pretlow is a physician from Seattle, and he created this space online where obese kids can talk anonymously. And he told Sound Effect's Kevin Kniestad how that made him realize that even he, as a doctor, didn't fully understand what these kids were going through.
I got into it kind of by accident. Back in the time of the dot-com heyday, I sort of started thinking maybe this thing called the internet might be useful to help manage children with health problems. I was a pediatrician in Seattle at the time. So I took a course at Bellevue Community College in how to create websites. And my project, I decided, would be a website for overweight kids. And I was absolutely flabbergasted that within about a year, more than 100,000 overweight kids from all over the world started using this little site. Over the next 10 years, these kids posted more than 140,000 messages on these little bulletin boards and did many, many days of chat rooms. And what they said was that information on healthy eating and exercise didn't help them, that they were overdosed on that, that they'd got that nonstop in schools and from their doctors and parents. They talked about comfort eating. They were comforting themselves with food when depressed, sad, lonely, stressed, or bored. And what they were really doing was using food like a drug. Once their brains realized that the pleasure of the food eased stress and depression and boredom, their brains apparently underwent changes to not only keep the behavior going, but at some point the child or the teen was not able to stop. And this really suggested like it was like an addiction, an addictive process. The level of human misery that is expressed in these bulletin board messages is just appalling. In the studies that we've done with talking to the children in a face-to-face, they don't admit this kind of struggles or unpleasant feelings about their life or their weight at all. But somehow, anonymously, they're willing to do that.
What are they saying on these message boards? What are they saying on the website that they aren't saying in person to other people?
This is a 14-year-old girl, 5'2", 201 pounds. She says, "It's like a drug. What used to satisfy you before now has no effect. I feel like I've become immune to the foods that used to comfort me. And like drugs, you keep moving on to bigger, worse things in order to get the same feeling as when you started out."
If a child finds comfort in eating a chip, a potato chip or a Doritos or something like that, where are they finding this comfort in that chip?
The sensory taste, the sweetness or the saltiness, is an emotion, essentially, and the brain does not feel two emotions at the same time. It does not feel pain and pleasure at the same time. So while they're sensing the pleasure of the taste or the saltiness or the sweetness of the food, that negates whatever unpleasant emotions they were having before that they were dealing with. But there's also the second component, which is the crunch. There have been amazing studies in rats where, for example, if you just annoy a rat with like noise or just putting a little paperclip on the rat's tail, which drives them crazy, the rats will overeat just standard rat chow to the point of becoming obese. Something about crunching soothes the brain. It's the way the brain seems to get rid of this nervous energy of the stress or the conflict that's going on. If you talk about food like a drug, of course, this is what seems to be going on. Food is a socially acceptable way of getting, if you will, drug benefits. It's got to become socially unacceptable to overeat, just like it is for smoking now. I mean, smoking 50 years ago, everybody did. It was cool. Now it's not cool at all, and people are shunned almost if they're smokers.
Hmm. How do you see some kids avoid it and some kids not? Where's the starting point? And lead me kind of down that road.
Parents control the food of younger kids. What happens, though, is some parents will give treats to their younger child, number one, to comfort the child, so that can start this whole thing rolling. Or the parents...
Kid starts crying, here, have this, if it'll...
Yeah, if he cries, give her a bottle. Mm-hmm. If he cries, mm-hmm. give her a bottle. Or if he's upset, give him a lollipop. Mm-hmm. Also, parents will give treats or food to children and grandparents to get love. One parent in our study had a 10-year-old, 282 pounds, and she said if she would not give him the treats that he demanded, he would get tremendously angry and just would make her life miserable. So she was now hostage to a food-addicted child, basically, and she was enabling this child ongoing just to prevent horrible things from happening.
So how do you rehabilitate?
They've got to understand how to basically deal with life without turning to food as a relief, a comfort thing.
So is it a matter of turning to something else?
Yes. You got to replace it with something else. This is the way they've learned to cope with life, is by eating their problems away, eating their emotions away. And they've got to learn to use other coping skills, other ways, like getting comfort from, which we suggest, pets, volunteer work. Certainly any kind of a social gathering is the best of all. As one child said, he formed a posse. He got with other overweight boys in his school and banded together against the bullies, and that worked. So there's power in numbers, and that gave him camaraderie as well, And the whole vicious circle of the loneliness and social disconnect reversed.
Dr. Robert Pretlow is the author of the book Overweight, What Kids Say. He created the website weightorock.com. That's W-E-I-G-H. He's based in Seattle, and he talked with sound effect producer Kevin Kenisted. We are looking into growing pains on Sound Effect this week from KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. In the early 1970s, Stephen Cosgrove was working as the vice president of an investment firm. And he was also a dad. And he loved to make up stories for his little girls. And they loved him. And it occurred to him that maybe some of those stories might make a good children's book someday. So he sort of dabbled in that, but mostly he was working at his firm as well as being kind of an unofficial consultant for an advertising company. And that meant sometimes going to meetings with important clients to give some feedback. So at one point he went to one of these meetings and the client there was the Space Needle. And he kind of found himself put on the spot.
The gal in charge of the meeting started saying, you know, what kind of ideas would you have? And I said, well, actually, I've just written a story, a children's story about the Space Needle, which I hadn't. And she said, what's it called? And the only thing I could think of that rhymed with needle was Weedle. And so I said, it's called Weedle on the Needle. And she said, what's it about? And I said, man, I'm just getting trapped by all these questions. And I said, it's a story about a Bigfoot character that lives on top of the Space Needle. And she said, this sounds perfect. This sounds like exactly what we need. She said, well, why don't you come back on Monday and show it to me? And so the scramble was on.
As Stephen Cosgrove drove home, he started cooking up this story. And by the end of the weekend, he had the bones of this story that became a really beloved bit of Seattle mythology. It's a great kid story, but it's also got a subtext. And it's really a parable about growing pains, about dealing with growth in the place that you live and learning to get along with new neighbors. So for the four or five of you who have never read Weedle on the Needle out there, let's start with a little synopsis.
Well, the story as I wrote it that Friday afternoon was basically a story about this creature who was native to Seattle and the environs and up in the mountains and living a very peaceful life and loving his isolation. And then came man. And they showed up and they began to develop everything and they were happier in heck. And it really irritated the Weedle. He didn't like the sound. He didn't like the noise. He didn't like the happiness. He just wanted to be left alone. And so what he did was he went up farther into the mountains and slept it away. Over time, Seattle and the whole area began to grow and grow and grow and grow. And pretty soon, what he thought was his private domain was encroached upon, and he needed to shut them up. He gathers together this plan to somehow stop the whistling. He tries to scare them. That doesn't work. And he tries to demand that they stop whistling, and that doesn't work. So he comes up with this plan to figure out that rain will mess up a whistle every time. Because if it's raining, it's very hard to whistle because your lips are wet. And so he grabs all the clouds he can, and he goes down and finds the tallest building in Seattle at that time was the Space Needle, and he goes up on top of it, and he begins to throw clouds high into the air, so it's raining all the time. And with all the rain, the people of Seattle got sadder, and they didn't work well, and they needed the happiness, and so the mayor of Seattle came to the Weedle and said, you've created this tremendous problem. What can we have to work together. And the Weedle explains why. He's got to sleep. He loves to sleep and he can't sleep with the whistling. And so the mayor gets together all the workmen and they put together and they build these gigantic set of earmuffs and they come back and they present it to the Weedle, who then can put the earmuffs on his ears and can sleep peacefully on top of the Space Needle, of which his nose begins to blink.
And there's the red light at the top.
And there's the red light.
So you wrote this book in 1974. It had a life of its own. And then in the early 2000s, it came back in a second edition. Can you tell the story of how the Weedle on the Needle was sort of resurrected and what happened there?
My publisher at the time was in New York, and they were kind of had their noses up in the air about what Seattle was and what Seattle stood for. It's just a regional book about Seattle, so who cares? And so as I realized that they were going to kill it, and I wanted it to come back again, and because I loved the character himself, I came back to Seattle, which I had moved away from, and discovered this wonderful little publisher called Sasquatch, and went to them and convinced them of the merit of the story and the fact that it could take its place where it needed to take its place. And they agreed and allowed me to kind of resurrect it. Now, one of the backstories on this is during the process with when Penguin was publishing, they modified the stories. They wanted to go in and see if they could contemporize. And they did some rewrites on that, and I kind of allowed them to do it, and I did it, a little bit of it myself. And by the time it was done, it lost its flavor. It lost the magic of what it is about Seattle. And that's, you can't take that away.
So you reissued it again in 2009 from some Seattle-based Sasquatch Books, and you restored that original origin story of the Weedle in the book, right?
Absolutely.
That was important to you. Why?
Well, there was something about that time in Seattle that was so magical and so energetic, you can't even believe what it was. There was a sense of community that really is not here right now. It's coming back. You can feel it a little bit more, but it kind of was disappearing. And it was a chance to go back to a time that was, you know, really charged with energy and really charged with magic, and where storytelling like that really, really was a good thing.
So the Weedle, the character, kind of took on a life of its own over the decades and became, you know, got used for all kinds of things, became the mascot for the Sonics for some years.
Right, and I was in that costume, so I know about that one.
You were?
Oh, yeah. No, I did that for 8 years.
Courtside?
Courtside. We
no
would
way.
Have, well, one, because it was fun to do, and it was a beautiful, very cool costume. That was Bill Russell all the way. I mean, I went into Bill Russell's office and said, I want to do this. And he said, he looked at me kind of funny, and he stood up, which is a lot of standing up. And he said, and what if I say no? And I said, then I'll buy a ticket as the Weedle, and I'll come anyway. and so he said, okay, he said, I'll tell you what you do. You come once. If the audience likes you, you're in, because we don't, and there were no mascots then. This was really the first NBA mascot. And he said, let's just see what happens. And it was magical.
You know, the Weedle just kind of became an unofficial Seattle mascot, right?
I mean, right. What I'd always hoped for and what I still hope for is that he becomes this mobile symbol, this goodwill ambassador for Seattle and what Seattle's heart is all about.
Your description of Seattle in the 70s feels very relevant today. Just the social tensions that come along with growth. You know, we've got neighborhoods turning over and gentrifying and changing and populations shifting around. We've got this whole population of, you know, tech workforce that is moving in really, really quickly. And again, you have all these sort of disconnects and mutual suspicions of newcomers and so on. It really just reminds me of the subtext of this book, of the idea of the natural suspicion that comes when newcomers arrive.
Right. And it is that. I mean, and you're so right, because it is just a metaphor about what has happened and what is happening. And it just never goes away.
Yeah. Well, Stephen Cosgrove wrote Weedle on the Needle in 1974, reissued it in 2002 and 2009. He's written like a zillion books besides that. And his newest one is called Pickles and the P-Flock Bullies, featuring a Puget Sound orca. Hey, thank you so much for being on Sound Effects, Stephen.
My pleasure. Absolutely.
Sound Effect comes to you from senior producer Arwen Nix and producer Kevin Kniestad. We had help this week from producer Matthew Stribe and intern Bree Ripley. Web help from Mike Lewis. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. If you haven't subscribed to our podcast yet, you should do that. We're on iTunes, and definitely think about writing a short review while you're there. You can send your feedback to soundeffect@kplu.org. We'll be back here next week to delve into origin stories.
And I don't blame them, but kids didn't know that. And I would say, I want to play soccer. And they would say, we don't want you on the team. And it was hard, you know? And so I, instead of letting that define me, I created him.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.